Don't you wish everything was more rewarding? With Rakuten, almost everything is. You can earn cash back on those new shoes you've been wanting. You can save on the next trip you book. You can cash in on groceries. Just join. Shop your favorite brands and save. Sephora, Boots, Argus, Temu, Adidas, Trip.com. The list is long. Save online at over 550 stores. And when it's time to redeem those rewards, get your money exactly how you want it. Choose bank transfer or PayPal. So go ahead, take a trip, fill a cart, get a new outfit. Rakuten is a world of rewards. Join today for free. Go to rakuten.co.uk or get the app. That's Rakuten.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Weekly. It's Wednesday, April 29th, 2026. On today's episode of the show, we're going to be talking about the latest film and TV news. We'll talk about the movie Apex that's on Netflix right now. We'll present interviews with Charlize Theron and Taron Egerton. We'll discuss Mother Mary, the new film from writer-director David Lowery, and play an interview with him. And then we'll also talk about Over Your Dead Body and provide interviews with director Jorma Taccone and stars Jason Segel and Samara Weaving. My name is Ben Pearson. I am an editor at slashfilm.com. We are not going to be talking about Michael on today's show. It's probably going to be one of the biggest hits of the year, and we're not going to be talking about it because I don't want to, and no one is making me. So if you want to hear a discussion of how the film did at the box office and the fraught nature of that whole project, Ryan Scott and I talked about that on this week's episode of our box office podcast called Movies Now More Than Ever, which you can subscribe to at patreon.com/popcultured with a D at the end. Okay, let's tear through some news items here. James Mangold is heading to the small screen to adapt his 1997 movie Copland for television. He's going to co-write, direct, and executive produce this TV version of that story. And I remember liking that movie a lot when I saw it 20-ish years ago. And it's streaming now on Paramount Plus and Hoopla if you want to check it out. I feel like I'm due for a rewatch for that one. So I feel like the premise of that movie, which is about a town that's just over the border into New Jersey, where a bunch of New York cops kind of like run the town and do dirty business, basically, is pretty ripe for a TV adaptation. I think that could work out pretty well. So fingers crossed on that. Meanwhile, Josh Rubin is co-writing and directing Heart Eyes 2, the sequel to the horror romance that he released last year. We talked about that movie on this podcast at the time, so you can go back and listen to that if you missed that conversation. Deadline says that Olivia Holt will be reprising her role as Allie, so that's good news for fans of the original movie, and that's set to come out on February 11th, 2028, just in time for Valentine's Day. Benedict Cumberbatch is going to star in and produce a TV series called White Smoke for A24, and this sounds really fun. It's based on a heist novel that's going to be published in 2027, and it's set among a group of duplicitous con men and thieves determined to steal the Vatican's most remarkable treasures during a papal conclave. So, conclave heist? Hell yeah, that sounds awesome. I kind of wish it was a movie, but we'll see how that show turns out. We've mentioned before on the podcast that Radio Silence, the directing team that just made Ready or Not 2, is going to be directing a new version of The Mummy with Brendan Fraser and Rachel Weisz. But that film is now shifting up on the calendar. We have a new release date for that. It's going to be coming out on October 15th, 2027. I believe it was originally scheduled for 2028. So that's good news. Michael B. Jordan and Austin Butler have closed their deals to star in Top Gun Maverick director Joe Kaczynski's Miami Vice movie at Universal, which will now be called Miami Vice 85, presumably to distinguish it from Michael Mann's 2006 movie. This one's supposed to come out on May 19th, 2028. And there's a couple pieces of extra news about the stars of that movie. So speaking of Michael B. Jordan, he's going to be producing and potentially starring in a movie adaptation of the video game Battlefield, which is going to be written, directed, and produced by Christopher McQuarrie, who has been stuck in Mission Impossible land for many, many years. I have never played Battlefield, but from what I gather, it's somewhat similar to Call of Duty. I'm curious if Jordan ends up starring in this one because he's just like attached as a producer and like might pop up as the star. I guess it depends on how quickly this comes together and whether he'll be able to fit it into his schedule, because he has the Thomas Crown Affair coming out next year that he directed and stars in. So he will likely need to carve out a bunch of time to do some press for that movie. So it remains to be seen if he's going to be able to fit it into his schedule. Austin Butler, the other person who's going to be in Miami Vice 85, is going to be part of the ensemble of Park Chan-wook's next movie, which he's been wanting to make for years, called The Brigands of Rattle Creek. It's a Western thriller about a sheriff and a doctor who seek revenge against a group of bandits who use the cover of a torrential rainstorm to rob and terrorize the occupants of a small town. This was written by S. Craig Zoller, who wrote Bone Tomahawk, which I think is one of the best Westerns of this century and maybe among the top 50 Westerns in history. I was trying to think about this. I have not seen every Western, obviously, but I've seen a lot of the big ones, and I really love Bone Tomahawk. So I'm going to stand by that. I'm going to say it's top 50 in history. Matthew McConaughey, Pedro Pascal, and Tong Wei from Decision to Leave are all on board to star in this alongside Austin Butler. I don't read very many scripts. I know there are a lot of people in my field who read any script they can get their hands on. I think I probably only read 4 or 5 scripts in my life of movies that have not been made yet, but I actually read this one probably 10 or 12 years ago, back when it was called The Brigands of Rattle Borge. It's now called The Brigands of Rattle Creek. And I remember thinking it was fantastic, so I'm really excited about this one. Meanwhile, Jeff Nichols, who I talked to on this podcast for The Bike Riders, he's one of my favorite working directors, is heading back home for a Southern Gothic movie called King Snake, which stars Margaret Qualley, Drew Starkey, and Michael Shannon, of course. Michael Shannon, a frequent collaborator of Jeff Nichols. And this is a supernatural horror movie that follows a young couple who inherit a farm in rural Arkansas and must conquer the demons, both physical and metaphysical, that haunt its legacy. Forces of good and evil collide in a terrifying film where real-world challenges crash headlong into otherworldly creatures and myths. That sounds great to me, so I am all on board for that one. Brian Helgeland, who wrote LA Confidential and Man on Fire, and he wrote and directed A Knight's Tale, has been hired to write the screenplay for a movie called Django Zorro, based on a 2014 comic that was co-written by Quentin Tarantino, in which Django from Django Unchained hangs out with Zorro. And I know they've been trying to get this one off the ground for a long time, and we know Tarantino is not going to be directing this. There's no word about casting yet, but I think it'd be cool if they could work it out to get Jamie Foxx and Antonio Banderas, since those guys have defined those characters for a generation. We'll see if this one actually makes it to the screen. I have my doubts, because it's been a long time since that comic came out, and there have been a lot of attempts to get this one going. So just because they hired a screenwriter doesn't mean that the movie's actually going to happen. So we'll see. At least they hired a good screenwriter. So that's a positive. Next up, The Beekeeper's Jason Statham is reuniting with director David Ayer for a new movie called John Doe, which has a script by Zach Penn, who has writing credits on Ready Player One and The Avengers. Statham is going to be playing a guy who has no memory, no past, and no name, and only one face he can't forget, Eliza. As fragments of his identity return, he discovers he was trained for a mission still in motion, and he's being hunted by the very people who sent him. With enemies closing in, he must choose between finishing what he started or protecting the one thing that makes him feel human, love. So Jason Statham doing like a Bourne-style movie? Sure, bring it on. Yeah, count me in. A couple pieces of casting news to wrap this up here. Laura Dern has replaced Helena Bonham Carter in The White Lotus Season 4, which is filming in France right now. And Emma Stone and Chris Pine are teaming up for a romantic comedy called The Catch, which is slated to come out in May of 2027. No plot details have been revealed for that one yet, but I like both of those actors quite a bit, so I'm excited about that as well. All right, that's it for the news. Let's take a quick break, and then we'll jump into our movie discussions. With me now is Slash Film editor and chief film critic, Chris Evangelista.
Hello.
All right, Chris, we're here to talk about Apex, which is the new movie from Baltasar Kormáker. He's the guy who directed films like Everest and what else did he do? Two Guns and Contraband, those old Mark Wahlberg movies, or old-ish. And he strikes me as like a very sort of sturdy action filmmaker. Like, I've never been in love with any of his movies, and I don't think I've ever outright hated any of them either. So what did you think about what he did with Apex here?
Yeah, you know, I think that this fits into that classification as well, where it's not great. It gets the job done. I feel like the movie mostly works because the two leads are really committed to their respective roles. But you know, this has that unfortunate Netflix sheen to it where nothing looks real. Like when I was writing the review for this, I was looking up info and I read that like they shot on location actually in Australia where the movie is set. But honestly, if you had told me like they shot this with like the volume, like where everything is fake, I would have believed that too. Like nothing, like there's yeah. like, there's multiple shots where they're trying to be like, look at the grandeur of nature. And it's like, this looks fake to me. And that's kind of a bummer. That's just like, I don't really think that's so much like the filmmaker's fault as it is like just the, if you want to call it that, the Netflix house style where everything just has to have this sort of like weirdly fake look to it. And that's a bummer. But, you know, plot wise, this isn't really doing anything new. Like there are so many movies with this premise, which is basically a very attractive woman who is grieving is chased by a killer. Like there are a ton of movies. Like, I mean, even Netflix has a recent movie like this called Don't Move, which which is like almost like the same movie where it's, you know, this woman, she's grieving. She goes out into the woods and a killer targets her. And I actually thought Don't Move was actually kind of better than this, like just because that was a little more pulpy. But, I enjoyed this overall.
Yeah, the interesting thing about Don't Move is that she gets injected with some kind of paralytic agent or something,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, so she and literally can't move, yeah.
Yeah, so that at least like adds like an extra twist to it. This one is pretty straightforward. It's just Charlize Theron is out in the middle of like the Australian outback or the wilderness or whatever, and she stumbles across Taron Egerton, who ends up being totally insane and ends up like hunting her the most dangerous game style almost across the landscape here. I guess let's put up a spoiler warning just so we can get into the nitty gritty here. So if you've not seen Apex, I'm sure it did very well on Netflix. It seems like the type of movie that's really designed to do that. But go check it out and then come back. And Chris, what did you think about Taron Egerton specifically? Because he really kind of, I mean, he's obviously like incredibly jacked in this movie. So like his physique is kind of awe-inspiring to behold in certain shots. But then his character is very, very different from like Eggsy, you know, the guy from the Kingsman movies where he kind of, or like even Eddie the Eagle, or like he kind of has this like, ah, shucks, I'm your friend. I'm a guy that you know. And yeah, I'm a little pretty, but I'm like the classic Hollywood good guy kind of archetype. And this is very much not that. So what did you think about him here?
Yeah, I thought he was really fun in this. I think this is a case of, he's another one of those actors who everyone tried to make him like a generic leading man because he's like attractive. He's an attractive guy, but mm-hmm. it's pretty clear he'd be much better as like a character actor. And I kind of like that, like he's starting to sort of lean into that. Like he gets to like, you know, go pretty crazy here. It reminded me a lot of Jai Courtney in Dangerous Animals, which is another movie about a beautiful woman in Australia being targeted by a killer. that movie I really liked a lot. And, you know, there was that period where Jai Courtney was also being slotted into like the generic Australian leading man. And in Dangerous Animals, he's like, gets to just like cut loose playing this like crazy serial killer guy. And it's sort of like, I'm just curious. I think it's interesting that like these actors who started out one way are sort of much better off playing, I don't even say against type, it's just more like they just haven't found the right role. And I'd be much more interested in seeing Taron Egerton playing parts like this than, you know, the Kingsman movies, which I think those movies are terrible. I know they have their fans, but I do not like those movies at all. So yeah,
I liked the first one and couldn't even make it through the second one. I thought it was atrocious. But okay, so what do you think about Charlize? I mean, obviously she's become like a huge action star. I had a chance to interview Charlize and Taron Egerton together. You'll hear that interview in just a minute. And I brought up the kind of action movie history that Charlize has. She's found herself in this really interesting position where she started her career one way and then she's just like found this lane and has really been able to capitalize on that in a really interesting way. So what do you think about what she was doing here?
Yeah, I completely bought into her performance. She's very good at making you believe she can do the various things she does in these movies. Like in like Atomic Blonde, I really believe that she can fight like that. And in this, I really believe she was handling herself. Like the big climactic movie where she's like climbing that cliff. She's like free soloing up that cliff. Like I bought into that. And I said, there's not like a lot to the characters here. They're not very complex. Her character is even less complex than the killer. But you know, it gets the job done. Everything here is very adequate. It's not like going above and beyond. It could have been a lot better, but it's not like a failure either. It gives you pretty much exactly what you want from a Netflix movie, where you watch it and then when it's over, you're just like, all right, I don't need to watch that again, but I didn't regret watching it.
Yeah, 100%. A lot of Netflix movies don't even meet that bar. Sometimes when I am done with one, I'll just be like, what the hell was that? Like, that wasn't a movie. That was some other thing, some other category of entertainment that doesn't exist, that's between TV and movie and slop. And it's just like, blah. Like I don't even know how to define it really. But like this and War Machine, the Alan Ritchson movie that came out not too long ago on Netflix, at the very least, they have trackable arcs and like a beginning, middle, and end. And I realize that's like the most basic requirement for a movie. So it's not like I'm trying to praise this movie for doing that. But when you compare it to some other Netflix stuff, specifically Netflix originals, it looks decent in comparison to those. So that's probably the best compliment that I can give it, which is, again, not like me lavishing a lot of praise on this movie. But I kind of like enjoyed it to a degree while I was watching it. And then I'll probably never really thinking about it again. So anything else about this that you thought stood out or was interesting? Like you mentioned the physicality, like believing Charlize in those rock climbing positions. I definitely did as well. The visual effects, man, like you talked about that already, but just like the look of it. I don't know if it's a lighting thing or like shooting stuff against plates and like the compositing not really being up to snuff, but there's just something about the look of this that just it kind of like
it just disappears.
Yeah, it disappears into like digital nothingness. Digital grime would even like imply that there's a style to it, and it just kind of like is fall off more than anything else. You know, it just kind of
it looks like a car commercial, basically like the all new Toyota, whatever. It just looks like a truck commercial. It's like, it's lit like that. And it's like there's this one shot, where I touched this in the review, where Charlize Theron gets like to the top of this cliff and the camera like zooms around her and it zooms back. And you're supposed to be like, wow, look at how secluded she is. And I was like, this just doesn't look like she's really there. Like, it looks like a video game. It looks like I don't know. And like, there's a bunch of shots underwater, which are so clearly not underwater. And it's like, I get it. Like, you don't want to like put your actors completely underwater in summer. Like, you know, it's hard to do, but there's got to be a better way of doing it than whatever's going on here. But I was like, the only other thing that really stood out to me is, there's a part early in the film where they introduce Taron Egerton's character and he's like selling jerky. And I watched this with my girlfriend and I was like, oh man, is there going to turn out to be like human jerky? And sure enough, that is what happened. Like later in the film, they reveal that yes, he is selling like human skin turned into jerky.
Yeah, my wife called that out instantly. She's like, there's no other reason for them to linger on that than for it to be some kind of reveal later. And like, what could the reveal possibly be? So that's just kind of like bad screenwriting, I think. Like they kind of really, what's the phrase? Is it lampshaded? I think, where you sort of like call attention to something like that. Maybe the movie might have been better off in like that that reveal could have played with more of like a gut punch or like a, oh my God, this guy is like more insane than we thought, if they didn't do that. But because they did that, you just kind of spend the whole movie going like, all right, let's get to the part where he's got the human bodies in a cave somewhere. So
yeah.
I did think his teeth were pretty deranged, like the sharp teeth and stuff. Like maybe that's an image from this movie that I will remember years from now or something.
I kind of wish they had like done more of that. Cause like after he shows her the teeth, like he puts the fake teeth back in. It's like, just leave them out, bro. Like what?
Yeah.
It's like, I got to put my dentures back in. Like she already knows. Like, what do you do?
Yeah. Yep. All right, cool. Well, that's Apex. It's on Netflix right now. And here is my conversation with Apex stars, Charlize Theron and Taron Egerton. So, Charlize, I'd love to hear about your experience developing Apex as a producer. Can you talk about that aspect of your work on this film?
It was great. This was a great film to develop. We had a script that was really great. It had a great blueprint. And I think the reason why we wanted to attack it was because it had so much potential to get even better. We spent a lot of time trying to find just the right writer, and we had a writer step in a couple of weeks before we started shooting, who did a lot of work on a show that I did called Mindhunter with David Fincher, Joe Pennell. And I had a lot of experience with him, and I wanted to bring him on because Taron and I, as actors, really wanted the two-hander part to be really great. So the action part of it was easier to figure out. You know, we get a great crew and they figure out great set pieces for us. But when we had these moments of the two of us, we really wanted a writer to kind of help us figure out how to break tropes. And the development part, I would say, primarily was trying to kill every single trope surrounding movies like this.
Yeah, that's great. Do you remember any big changes from that original script that you first read, like a specific example of how something changed over that course of that development?
Yeah, I mean, the character of Ben was a completely different guy. I mean, he was a completely different guy until Taron came on and brought so many incredible ideas and things for us to think about. And the character that you see in the film is definitely a character that was developed with Taron.
That's awesome. Well, Taron, your character, I mean, initially he seems to be this nice guy who has Sasha's best interest in mind, and then we learn that he has something much more sinister planned. Can you tell me about subverting that good guy persona and ultimately going like full villain in this one to play somebody who's like really deeply disturbed?
It's really interesting you use the word nice. I'm quite interested in the idea of nice and like what it means, you know, because it's kind of bullshit, isn't it? And I think there's something really fun about being able to play with that in a character, play a performed version of yourself, and then kind of pull back the veil and go, actually, I'm this rancid excuse for a human being. I don't know. It was... When Charlize and the other producers and Kira Goldberg at Netflix originally approached me about it, it was everyone had such an open mindset. And as much as it being an appealing prospect, doing this, you know, really exciting action film with Charlize and playing a great character, the thing that I really could sense and was excited by was It felt like a really great creative open forum. We had we were really diligent about having weekly or twice weekly script meetings, and we would get together on Zooms in advance of shooting and even into the film to really mine and craft and further develop the material. And you know, the bottom line is that lots of movies get made, and it's not always the fact that everyone cares that much to be doing it at 10 p.m. after you've just done a 12-hour day of filming, you know, and I really thrive in those kind of environments, I think.
Yeah, that's wonderful. So, Charlize, you're obviously no stranger to roles that require just a tremendous amount of physicality. That's been a big part of your skill set as an actor for a long time. Was there a moment in your career where you made a conscious decision to start actively seeking out parts that presented you with the opportunity to showcase those skills?
Yes, I had done an action movie earlier than this, but I didn't really get I didn't find an affinity. I didn't think like, oh, I would want to. It was actually a very traumatic experience, so I didn't make an action movie for a long time until I got offered Mad Max Fury Road, and I think that movie really kind of reminded me how much I like physical storytelling. And so I made a real, well, not myself, but our production company made a real concerted effort to find material that we could develop around that. And that's how Atomic Blonde came about, and the Old Guard sequel, and the two Old Guard films, and then this. I think we ended up wanting to test the waters, you know, to see what we could do that felt like pushing the envelope and trying to reach for things in the genre that we like, that we don't see a lot of. And physically, for me, it became, I was like, if I'm going to do this, let's do it. Like, let's really do it. And that's been that kind of journey for the last 10 years.
Well, I mean, watching Apex, I can tell that even if the production might have been filming on a soundstage in some scenes, you really cannot fake the physicality that both of you guys are sort of showcasing in this movie. I know they can do amazing things with face replacement and stuff like that these days, but like, it really looked like you were out there in a kayak for a bunch of shots, and like, you're still climbing on some kind of rock wall, even if some of the backgrounds might have been enhanced with visual effects later.
Yeah, we only shot on a stage for 3 weeks. The rest of the film was all on practical location. And so the majority of that film is really happening in the gorges that you see, and everything about it is real. Nothing, sure, we've enhanced a little bit of an extra river for you to see in the back, but aside from those things, everything is really practical. Even the ascent that I have on the top of the mountain, that was an actual gorge that was way past 60 feet that we decided to hang me off and have me free climb up there, which I still don't understand how that happened. But it was the kind of film that we set out to make, so Baltasar Kormákur, our director, really likes that kind of practical aspect too. But I'm very proud to say that when you watch the film, we don't have face replacement except for a few water shots. I have some help on the kayaking stuff. Not a lot of rapids in Australia, so they went and shot some second unit in New Zealand with two gold stuff that I was never going to learn in 3 months.
Yeah.
But the climbing is all me. I did 100% of all the climbing and the bouldering in the middle of the film.
That's incredible. Yeah, and Taryn, I mean, you're really getting after it in this movie, too. It really felt like you just left it all on the table. Was that physical component of your performance, of what this role demanded, a big part of the draw for you?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I think, you know, I really am of the belief that the best acting is when you're able to move kind of beyond what's very cerebral and really kind of get into your body and be playful and present. And when you're doing a movie that is as physical as this, that actually becomes a kind of an ace up your sleeve in terms of trying to get to a place where you do good work. And for me, what I really enjoyed was finding the balance between him being this very physical character who does live this quite extreme lifestyle out in the wilderness, but also him being kind of a bit of a kind of sprite, you know. I kind of thought of him as like a bit of a pixie out in the woods, being very, very strange, but kind of wanted him to be very kind of light on his feet and kind of playful. I think weirdly, he's one of the most playful roles I've played, I think.
Yeah, pixie with very, very sharp teeth. That's very funny.
Yeah.
So Charlize, I think I have time for one more question. Sasha frequently finds herself under threat by various men in this movie, whether it's in a gas station, in her car, out in the wild. And even though ultimately it kind of gets pretty heightened, I think unfortunately a lot of people, and especially women, can relate to that feeling. So I was just curious if you could talk a little bit about how you wanted Apex to grapple with that idea.
Yes, I mean, I love female-driven action film, because I think there's an element to it that a man can't bring to action film, which is, you know, I feel like for a man, it's like, how do I just conquer this and fix this and get over it? And I think for women, it starts earlier. It's like the awareness before the action even starts. I think we have like a sixth instinct. Like, there's something about us that I don't think we're born with. I think the human condition, we have a little bit of that set in our brain. But for women, I think it's been heightened over the years, of seeing so much gender-based violence. You know, I think women in general think something like that is going to happen, not necessarily like an apex, but the idea that at some point you're going to be under threat and that you have to somewhat constantly think of that. And, you know, I think we wanted to not get too caught up in, you know, the minutiae of it, but it definitely, to me, played a big part in knowing who the character was.
For sure. All right, well, I'm out of time with you both, but thank you very much for the time today, and congrats on the movie.
Thank you.
With me now is Slash Film editor Jacob Hall.
Hello, hello.
All right, Jacob, we're here to talk about Mother Mary, which is David Lowery's new movie. I just got to tell you, I feel so enriched by this film. I saw it last night and just had an incredible time. What do you think about this one?
Yeah, I saw it 2 weeks ago so I could interview Lowery. That interview is now on slashfilm.com. He's a great talker. I hope you read it. But yeah, so I went in not knowing much beyond the trailer, which is very vague. And I think I love most of Lowery's movies. There's a few of them I'm a little iffier on, but I feel he's always so thematically ambitious. He's always shooting for the stars. And I think Mother Mary is a really tough film to describe. It's a gothic horror pop musical about broken friendships, largely set in one room. And I was captivated and compelled the whole time. And even when the emotional climax is not predictable, but simple and not complicated, the journey to that was really, like you said, enriching. I really love Mother Mary.
Yeah, it's so good. And Lowery does this really interesting thing. He did this with The Green Knight too, where he uses symbols in ways that I feel like are pretty open-ended for people to be able to kind of place whatever reading on them that you want. And there's this kind of, this color red is a big deal in this movie. And there's this kind of ghostly entity that, you know, you can kind of read in a number of different ways. And it almost doesn't really matter what it's supposed to represent, because the film is able to bear the weight of any number of interpretations, which I think is just like a real testament to the quality of the writing here. I was blown away by not only the way that it's able to kind of carry the symbolism of these big thematic ideas on its shoulders, but also just literally the back and forth conversation, the dialogue that these characters have. Michaela Cole and Anne Hathaway star in this movie. Most of the film is them just having extended conversations with each other. And I was just rapt the entire time. What'd you think about the writing of this?
Yeah, I think those of you who don't know how to watch the trailer, the basic premise is that Anne Hathaway is a world-famous pop star who returns to her former best friend and costume designer, played by Michaela Cole, who's now a celebrated artist in her own right, with a request to make her a new costume for her upcoming concert. And this ends up having very supernatural strings attached, I'd say. And yeah, it's mostly these two like former friends having a very tense conversation about their past, with flashbacks to Anne Hathaway's Mother Mary performing these big concert scenes, which we'll get to in a second, I assume. But yeah, this movie kind of lives or dies on, are you interested in Cole and Hathaway, like their back and forth? And I love how these two are written, because it's not like a screaming match. It's not snarky. You get a little bit, a true sense of history here. And it doesn't feel like a fake, phony, you know, friends broke up, now they're together. It feels like two people who really hurt each other, and that the interactions, like, they cut deeper than you'd expect, like this type of movie to do. I really appreciated how it was not an easy, clear dynamic.
Yeah, totally. I was talking with my wife about it after we saw the film, and she mentioned that this felt like a North Star, where you can point to it and be like, see, this is how you write a script. It can be done well. And I think I'm going to adopt that idea of like the North Star movie, one of the small handful that come around every year that kind of reinvigorate me as a movie lover and point the way for what's possible. So this is absolutely one of those for 2026. And if you've not seen Mother Mary, I highly recommend it. I know it's going to be probably not like a huge, huge movie, especially since it's coming out the same weekend as Michael, which is going to suck up a lot of the oxygen in the room. But man, I cannot emphasize enough how impressed I was. I feel like if I was part of the the Academy, I would give this movie Best Original Screenplay if the Oscar deadline was right now, like for 2026. I thought the writing was so, so sharp here. So, yeah, what else do you want to talk about? Oh, you mentioned the songs. Let's talk about that. What did you think about the music in the movie?
Yeah, the songs, there's two song credits. Most songs are by Charlie XCX and Jack Antonoff, and there's one by FKA Twigs, who has a small role in the movie as well. I think this may be the most convincing fake pop star I've ever heard in a movie, Ben. Because I've been listening to the Mother Mary soundtrack nonstop since it was released. And if they decide to like put Anne Hathaway in this character and do a whole concert series and more albums, I would listen to it. It's so often a movie will say, here's a world famous pop star, and you listen to like a track or two and be like, or like the fake track or two in the movie, and you go, yeah, that's fine for a movie, but I wouldn't enjoy that in real life. I wouldn't fill stadiums in real life. But I think the Mother Mary soundtrack legit feels like real great music.
Yeah, it was very enjoyable. I think A24, they might have nailed this because they released that movie Opus last year. Did you see that? The Io Debris movie?
No, I missed Opus.
Okay, so it's like she goes out to some compound where John Malkovich plays this reclusive singer, and they play some music that Malkovich sings, and he's supposed to be like releasing this, I mean, as the title indicates, this opus onto the world. And I thought they did a really good job with that as well. So yeah, something about A24, I mean, I'm sure it's just coincidental that distributor is releasing both of these movies. I don't think they have like any sort of a music team there that like crosses films or anything, but yeah, it's just an interesting coincidence. But what do you think about the performances? I mean, it feels like I haven't seen Michaela Cole in anything in a little while. I remember she was in Black Panther 2, and she's popped up here and there. I mean, obviously, like I May Destroy You, the HBO show, was where she got on a lot of people's radar. But I thought she was incredible in this. What did you make of the performances across the board?
Yeah, 99% of this movie is either Anne Hathaway or Michaela Cole. I mean, Hunter Schafer's in it very briefly, and a few other actors who pop in for like very small bits. But this really is a two-hander, like almost completely through. And I think both of them are amazing. I love Anne Hathaway as well. Michaela Cole has like her character like cuts so much with so little effort. Like single words are like knives in Anne Hathaway's mm-hmm. body. But like shout out to Anne Hathaway though, who is the person who's absorbing the punishment throughout this movie in more ways than one. It's a very physical performance. She's doing some like in the concert flashbacks. She is very much doing the full on pop star performance. She is doing the dancing, the singing, and is really impressive doing so. So when it cuts to the contrast of her, you know, coming to her friend for help, it is to see her so broken down and bedraggled is this incredible contrast of two Anne Hathaways. And without spoiling anything, there's a dance scene where Michaela Cole asked her to dance for her. And it's one of the strangest things I've seen any actor do. And all power to Michaela Cole for commanding that scene and Anne Hathaway for having the vulnerability to pull it off.
Yeah, they both really commit in great ways. I have not seen The Christophers, which is the movie that's in theaters right now. It's just not in theaters near me. But that one stars, who is it? Oh, Ian McKellen and Michaela Cole. And then, interestingly, Anne Hathaway also has a new movie coming out. I think it's next weekend, Devil Wears Prada 2. So like both of these women are leading multiple movies in the same month. Just a very unusual thing, I think. But man, yeah, I was just like, again, very, very impressed. And I'm just kind of reeling from the movie still. I saw it last night. We're recording this early on Friday morning. And I'm just like turning over these images from the film over and over again in my head. And I think Lowry is just like, he has entered another level here, man. He is just like leveled up in a really, really big way. I love so much of his stuff. And I think you're a big fan of him too, across the board, right?
Yeah. Green Knight and Peach Dragon especially are my two previous favorite Lowry movies. I think Green Knight is still my favorite, but I need to see Mother Mary again, you know, before I start like ranking it. But I like that A24 has become Lowry's home for him, like taking these giant swings. I'm not as big on A Ghost Story as other people are. I'm glad it got made. I'm glad it exists. But yeah, I just love that he, like, how do you pitch this movie? How do you make this movie? How do you say, I want to make a two-person chamber piece that's also a ghost story that uses religious symbolism as a way to frame pop music? I don't know where else you get this made other than A24. I'm so glad David Lowry was able to get this made.
100%. All right, so let's go. You had a chance to speak with David Lowery about this, so let's go to that interview now. What do you want to say in terms of setup here?
I will say this was not like a cozy studio where they recorded the audio beautifully. This was set up for a written Q&A, so it was like me with my phone chatting with him. And the audio, when the audio starts, he's literally asking me about my tattoos. So when the audio starts, you'll literally hear him me talking about all things in my arms and him asking about them in general. So it was like way right into the interview. So the audio quality will be a little less than usual, and we're going to jump right into it and get to hear me stumble and fumble through all the things that usually get cleaned up in a written Q&A. So with those notes in mind, I think Lowery is a terrific interview. So hope you enjoy it.
Excellent. Yeah, this is a fantastic conversation. And here is Jacob and David Lowery.
I'm taking quick stock of your Starship Enterprise.
Enterprise, yeah.
And then a Ghost.
Yeah, I have a Ghost.
Amazing.
I have David Bowie, a Goose, and just some fantasy stuff.
So. We like all the same things.
Yeah, good to know. Well, you and I clearly both like Renaissance artwork.
Yes.
Yeah, because all the backstage stuff, it goes beyond the halo on Mary's head, but goes into how you stage the tableaus around her, all of the... her background assistants or dancers.
Yes.
It feels very driven by that cryptic type of Renaissance art.
It was something that I'd already been leaning into in The Green Knight, sometimes mm-hmm. in the way we'd arrange people in the Great Hall or just creating these tableaus with the characters. And that led to, we took that idea and ran headfirst into it with Mother Mary. I really wanted the religious iconography to lead the way.
Were you always a fan of that, or was Green Knight sort of where you kind of were awakening, oh, this art fascinates me?
That was the first time that I felt, sometimes you are pulling lighting references and you'll turn to Rembrandt or Vermeer, but that was the first time where I felt like my films could, or one of my movies could directly participate mm-hmm. in that visual language. Mm-hmm. But it was always a part of my life. I was raised in a very religious household, so, mm-hmm. I mean, the first time I went to Europe, my dad just took me all over Rome, all over Italy, looking mm-hmm. at all of the greats in person. And so it was, and we had books of all that artwork growing up. It was definitely an iconography that I was familiar with.
And I saw this with my art history major wife. I was talking about the Renaissance symbolism afterward. And because I went to art school as well, so I was trying to look smart. And I said, do you throw some Dutch Baroque in the non-concert scenes? So I asked, is there Dutch Baroque influence in non-concert scenes? The way the shadows are in those scenes.
I wish I could sound smart and say yes. I could say that I went to see the big Vermeer exhibit mm-hmm. in Amsterdam right before we started shooting. So maybe some of that seeped in there.
Yeah, she said I was overthinking it, but I need to double check for sure.
Yes.
All right.
But I'd be making myself sound smarter than I am to say yes. There was definitely references to this quite literally, but it was in there.
I want to linger on the tableau one more time because even the way you've directed the extras, the facial expressions, the poses, they are very drawn from those exaggerated
yes.
poses. How do you direct that to your actors, to your team? Do you show paintings, or do you have it in your head and you try to replicate the best you can?
I would draw a lot of pictures for this one, and I'm not the best artist, but I could just draw the shapes, and sometimes it would just be a matter of explaining to them how they fit into the frame mm-hmm. and here's where you're going to be, here's how you are going to be standing, you need to land here at this point and make this gesture. There was a lot of physicality involved in the staging of these scenes. Sometimes with big groups mm-hmm. there's that scene backstage where she meets FKA Twigs for the first time, and it's one take, lasts about 3 or 4 minutes. And we did it 25 times to get all of those pieces to land consecutively right. in these perfect tableaus with all these moving pieces in them. And then in the barn with Michaela and Annie too, that was there was a lot of choreography involved in just standing and striking a certain pose. Mm-hmm. This was a movie that is riddled with poses. Right. Everyone was constantly striking poses. And that was the language that I was trying to use to express things.
I mean, go back to the literal early definition of icon before we, sort of brutalized it yes. into what it is now. But the idea of taking what we think icon now, pop star, but icon means something so different in the artistic tradition.
What's the word. Exact trend, the Greek trend? It comes from a Greek word, because I was looking it up recently, because I was for another project. this is the middle ground. I've got another project that's also dealing with religious icons, and I'm going to not be able to sound as smart as I'd like because I can't remember what, but it comes from the Greek
right.
and it does reference. We should look it up. We should look it up together and learn this together.
We'll do it right now.
Yeah.
For those, this will be the part you have to cut out of the interview, but yeah. Let's see. Definition of icon.
The origin, yeah. The etymology.
Let's see. Icon, let's go. Let's see, let's find gay.
Iconos or something is the word.
Yeah, in Eastern Orthodox Christianity, a representation of sacred events, or especially of a sacred individual, such as Jesus, Virgin Mary, or a saint, used as an object of veneration or a tool for instruction.
The object of veneration is very clear.
Yeah.
It's the way in, the way in which those figures are even, the poses they strike, it's meant to be genuflected in front of when you look at them. I also love the text that's inscribed in all of those Eastern Orthodox icons, the symbols that are up in the corners, and that there's a ritual to not only the characters that are represented, but the context in which they're represented in those paintings. Mm-hmm. I love the gold leaf that they used to illuminate the halos, which was something that I tried to reference very directly in the crowns that the king and queen wear in The Green Knight.
Right.
And when I started writing this film on the set of The Green Knight, I very quickly just grabbed those crowns and wrote them into the opening scene.
Yeah, so what came first then? Was it the religious icon, a pop star? Or was a pop star on your brain already? Like, what was it? What was the order of that?
I had been wanting to make something with a pop star for a long time. That was a long-term goal of mine because I love pop music. The movie was born of something else. The movie was born of an internal dialogue, a conversation I was having with myself about art and expression and all the things tied to that are attached to being someone who expresses themselves for a living. And I very quickly knew that I did not want to make a movie about a filmmaker, but that I could take all of these questions about filmmaking that I had and transpose them into the world of pop superstardom. Once I did that, it became something else. It ceased to be autobiographical. I started to invent characters rather than just purely rely on self-reflection. But it was a very immediate sense that this was the right direction to take the movie. Like it was the first night that I sat down to write it. I was like, oh, as I'm writing this, it occurred to me this can. Or I realized like a thunderstruck moment. This is going to be my pop star movie.
Yeah. But Mother Mary is very viable as a pop star. You watch the performances, you hear the songs, you go, oh, this sounds like a real artist. It sounds like I've been listening to two of these songs on repeat. And that's always a challenge for any movie to create like a fake pop star and like sell, oh, millions of people would listen to this in packed stadiums. But this sounds like I would listen to this. So what was the trick to making that like actually feel like a real thing?
It was much harder than I expected it to be. I knew that it was possible, but I also knew that it was a tall order because I've seen movies with fictional pop stars before that have great songs in them, but they don't stick the way, you know, the best of pop songs do for one reason or another. And I think it required an entirely holistic approach. It had to work not just for the movie, not just for the artists who were writing the songs, but for Annie who had to perform them. I thought at first that I could just give her 5 songs and she could sing them and we'd be done. But she very wisely explained to me that those songs need to be personal to her as an artist as well. They need to be personal to Anne Hathaway and to Mother Mary and to David Lowery and to Jack Antonoff and Charlie XCX. And that required a constant process of exploration and revision and trying to synthesize what it was that was important about this fictional artist, what she represented, not just to us, but to the culture that we were imagining she participated in.
Right.
And none of these are things that you can just hit with a bullseye. You can't just throw a dart and nail it. It takes a lot of rinsing and repeating, or in Anne's case, a lot of going into the studio and recording the songs over and over and over again, adjusting lyrics, trying out different things until you finally find that alchemical synthesis that allows you to achieve whatever it is that great pop artists achieve that makes your song so good. I feel like we scratched the surface of it. Hearing you say that you would listen to these songs outside of the context of the movie makes me very happy, because we were trying so hard and we really were up against just like we have to finish the movie. We have to go to the mix. The songs have to be done now. But it was a real, I wish we could just keep writing a Mother Mary album.
There's a old tradition of a certain type of gothic horror story where two old friends meet in an old building and one shares a tale so spectacular. Do I believe this? So yeah, I wanted to ask, like, this feels like a modern update on like something that would have been published in, you know, 1870. As a compliment, did you draw from that tradition?
Definitely. I mean, I was very clearly, this isn't exactly that story, but I was really clearly drawing on Rebecca. Mm-hmm. And like, I dreamed of Mandeville last night. It's sort of like the mindset in which I imagined Mother Mary arriving at Sam's house. Mm-hmm. And I wanted the house to feel like one of those classic English Gothic, or one of the grand old manors that exists in those classic English Gothic novels. I wanted to participate in that tradition, partially because I'm an Anglophile, partially because I always referred to this as my goth movie. And I know that being goth and the Gothic literary tradition are separate things, but there is an intersection that I'm very keen on zeroing in on. And I also just love that vibe. When we were shooting The Green Knight, again, we were in these old barns in Ireland that we'd used to build our sets within. And I remember thinking, like, it's a shame we're building a set in here. This whole space is just so spectacular in and of itself. I wish I could set a movie here. And so when I started writing this two-hander, I again, much like I grabbed the crowns from The Green Knight, I just grabbed that medieval barn from the English moors and decided that was going to be where Sam's workshop was.
So at work on a company Slack, where all of my writers and editors are together, I told everybody I was seeing this movie, I was talking to you, and started a meet discussion about your work. People immediately started, it's funny to see people go like, oh, I love a ghost story. To Bill saying, oh, that movie frustrates me so much. And but everybody at the same time goes, oh, we all agree Peace Dragon's great. Like, oh, yeah, we all agree Peace Dragon, of course.
Yeah.
So does it delight you to hear that people like are fighting but also uniting over your work?
I love it. It's great. It's also really makes me happy that everyone seems to agree about Pete's Dragon. Because for me, that movie is so special to me. It's so personal to me. And it represents something, the further I get from it, you know, a time in my life that was very transformative, where I was really coming into it my own as a filmmaker. And so to know that, you know, when I make a movie that is intentionally confrontational like A Ghost Story, or intentionally divisive like Mother Mary will certainly be, I also love knowing that I'm capable of making something like Pete's Dragon that can unify.
Yeah.
And that is, it's a safe place. You know, a lot of times I love being brave and being courageous with my movies and charting, going out in uncharted territory, but sometimes I want to be just, I want a warm hug. And Pete's Dragon is that. I don't know if you saw the short film I did called An Almost Christmas Story that's also a Disney movie. It's one of my favorite things I've made, and it's probably the most widely, at this point, the most widely seen thing I've made. And I love it so much because it does nothing but make people happy. And sometimes that's all I want to do.
Are there two David Lowrys? Are there the ones who makes Disney movies and the one who make Mother Mary? Or are they still the same person and adult?
They're the same person, but sometimes the distance between them grows further. Sometimes they grow further apart. And that distance and that tension between the two of them is what Mother Mary was born of.
I have 2 minutes left, so I'm going to check my best question to end this. So I was thinking about what sums up your movies, what unifies your movies. Like, I was trying to like go beyond, like, you know, interest in religious symbolism, and going to, like, I feel like all of your movies tend to anchor around, I say this in a couple anyway, a simple idea, a simple emotional truth, but you often take almost like a labyrinth way to get there. I feel like you as an artist are interested in walking through the labyrinth to find a simple truth. Am I on something that would interest you?
I would say so, because I'm always trying to get to the heart of something. I'm trying to like distill something to its essence. But one of the things I'm always interested in distilling is iconography. I always want to get to the heart of an icon. And I think one of the unifying aspects of my movie, of my body of work, is that they're all centered around icons. Mm-hmm. Some more than others. I'd say maybe Pete's Dragon is the least of those. Mm-hmm. But everything else, it's the outlaw archetype. Mm-hmm. It is the knight on a quest archetype. It is the pop star archetype. And all of those archetypes are unified in their iconographic presence in our culture. And I love taking iconography. I love taking these archetypes and peeling them away. peeling away the surface, peeling that paint, peeling that gold leaf away, and finding out what's underneath.
Yeah.
Just taking that, Peter Pan is a great example. You think of Peter Pan, you think of a silhouette of a little boy in a window with his arms at his waist.
Right.
And I was like, we have to have that in the movie, but then we also have to understand what's broken within him. Mm-hmm. And that's not to say everything's broken. Yeah. It's not all about trauma. But like, I really want to know the person behind, the individual behind the archetype.
What's really satisfying about Mother Mary in like in Reunite, probably my, Reunite's my favorite of your movies. Like that.
Thank
Mother,
you.
And I think both of them have a similar path where I'm watching and I'm thinking really hard, going, okay, what is it we're trying to tell me? It's going down all these interesting avenues, all these different ways it's going about itself. And when you get to the final moments, you go, oh, it's actually about something that's like really simple. And that,
yes.
That connects a base. Like the journey seemed complex, but the finale is like, oh, yeah, it was there all along. So
It's true. I'm a very circuitous, in some ways, storyteller, but also that's very representative of life, probably. Yeah. I have not lived the fullest extent of life yet, but I feel like when I look back on it, we take a long way towards getting to a very simple destination. Mm-hmm. It's a long, hard path. And when I'm making a movie, particularly when I'm editing a movie, I try out so many different things. I try every possible combination of scenes. I try, you know, removing things. I try cutting out all the dialogue. I try doing a silent version. And every version has its value. But then at the end of the day, you get to something that is pretty close to what you wrote.
Mm.
It's not too far from the script ever. And I sometimes think to myself, couldn't I save myself some trouble by just editing the movie according to the script? Just sticking to the script and just cutting that and being done with it? But to really understand the movie I made, I have to go down all of those random paths and blind alleys and circuitous, bramble-filled, dark forest, you know, paths. And I think it's a necessary part of the journey. And so I suppose when I'm writing, I'm doing the same thing in some ways. I could just, you know, cut to the chase, but the chase wouldn't be worth it if I hadn't taken the long way around.
Well, I'm glad you took the long way around.
So. Thank you.
Right, thank you so much.
I'm joined now by Slash Film editors BJ Colangelo.
Hi, hi, hiya.
And Brad Oman.
Hey, that's me.
So several months ago, the three of us recorded an episode of Pop Cultured ranking our favorite Lonely Island movies. So we're all fans of Yorma Taconi here. He's the director of Over Your Dead Body, a new movie. This is a very different type of thing for him, though. This almost feels a little bit more like a job for hire kind of gig. So without that kind of classic Lonely Island sensibility, just as a standalone movie that doesn't really have anything to do with that, BJ, what did you make of Over Your Dead Body?
So before I dive into this, I have a question for the both of you. Have either of you seen the 2021 film that this is based on, The Trip?
I have not.
No.
Okay. So I think that that context is also very important because if you've seen that movie, which is a very funny movie, there's a lot of humor in that movie that I think is lost a little bit in translation, the same way that I think like the Speak No Evil remake is actually pretty good because it's very American in its sensibilities compared to its, you know, origin country. This movie, I think, does the same thing. And I think Yorma is actually the perfect person to take this story and make it funny in a way that Americans will understand while also feeling so wildly different from everything else that he's done. So with that context in mind as well, I enjoyed this movie quite a bit. And there's a couple of things in it that we'll talk about later that should make me not like this movie. And yet I'm very much on board with this movie.
Okay. I was not a huge fan of it, even though, like I said, I like Yorma a lot. Brad turned me on to the Lonely Island and Seth Meyers podcast, so I'm listening to him every week and have like a newfound appreciation for his work. And I found this movie to just be okay, but that's the reason I had both of you on for this conversation, because I kind of want to like take a back seat here, because Brad, I think you liked this a lot more, right?
Yeah, I really dug this movie too. Like BJ said, I think it's a great meshing of Yorma's comedic sensibilities that you would expect from The Lonely Island, albeit in a subdued manner, combined with a really gory, dark twisted kind of comedy that you only really saw from him in like little snippets in like MacGruber here and there. They definitely had some like gross out violence and, you know, and things like that. But this, it's a completely different tone, and it's really different for someone like Jason Segel too. And it was really satisfying seeing him in a role like this, teamed up with Samara Weaving, not to mention the outstanding supporting roles for Timothy Oliphant and Juliette Lewis. And it's, yeah, I just had a really good time watching this. I loved seeing the little tiny flourishes that were very much in the vein of Lonely Island, that like Yorma stuck in there here and there, but he definitely understood the assignment and really knew that he had to deliver something that was much different than his traditional output. And I had a great time with it.
Yeah. One of the things that I really did appreciate about the movie is I thought there was like almost a Tarantino style escalation in terms of the reveal of different characters showing up. And I guess because people have probably seen the trailer at this point, this is not too much of a spoiler to say that, Brad, you already mentioned them, Timothy Oliphant and Juliette Lewis, and there's one other guy, I don't have the actor's name in front of me, are
Keith
playing
Jardine.
They're playing like a trio of escaped convicts, basically, and the way that they are incorporated into this story and introduced in this story reminded me a lot of something like that moment in Inglourious Basterds when the camera kind of like pulls back and you realize that there are more people in that bar than you originally thought, or a similar thing that happens in The Hateful Eight, where like you realize that the situation that you've been watching is not exactly as it appears. And I thought that aspect was pretty cool, but it just really wasn't enough to like justify the entire experience of watching this for me. But Brad, what did you think about like what this movie was doing structurally?
Yeah, I think that structurally is one of the things that makes the movie so interesting, because even though I had seen the initial trailer for Over Your Dead Body, I either had forgotten or I didn't really pay full attention to how Timothy Oliphant and Juliette Lewis and Keith Jardine came to be involved in the story. So when they became part of the plot, I was really surprised by that, and I liked that it kept flashing back and showing us like before and like setting up things and explaining how things happened before we got to that point in the story. It definitely added a bit more intrigue, allowed for some really great comedic moments, and I'll just say too, on the side, Keith Jardine is the like secret MVP of this movie. He is hilarious in this movie. He's so good.
BJ, I'm guessing you have thoughts about that performance and probably the structure as well, right?
Oh, definitely. And I agree. I think that he is kind of the secret weapon of this movie, because he's a former like MMA fighter. So he's got this like massive, bulky body, and he's very physical, but he's so funny. And he really does hold his own with Timothy Oliphant and Juliette Lewis, who are obviously these like seasoned professionals. But I really enjoy the structure of this movie because it reminds me so much of the explosion of movies like this that we got post Hays Code against the backdrop of the Vietnam War. The one that is probably the most obvious is Wes Craven's Last House on the Left, where it is this ridiculous exploitation film where everything is so heightened. But as I mentioned this in my review that I did for the site, this is an exploitation movie existing in our current timeline, which is beyond satire. So like, you have to make fun of it. You have to make it comedic, and you have to point out how ridiculous this all is, because we're just not operating the way that we were in the 1970s. So it's a really fascinating way of how do you tell these sorts of stories with this sort of violence, with this sort of pitch black comedy during a timeline where everything is like, how many times a day do we open our phones and see something that like our actual president is saying, and we're like, what are we even doing here, guys?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. I want to put a spoiler warning up. So we're going to spoil Over Your Dead Body. If you've not seen the movie yet, go check it out. Come back and listen to the rest of this conversation. I just want you guys to be able to have the freedom to cook in any way that you want and talk about any aspect of the movie that you want. BJ, actually, you kind of like alluded to this. This is like a relationship story at the heart of it. And I think that is something that you know, it's pretty clear from the marketing what the kind of central dynamic between Jason Segel and Samara Weaving's characters is going to be over the course of this. But what did you think about how that was explored in this film, how that evolved over the course of it, and also what the movie ultimately was trying to say?
Yeah, so this is a relationship film, but it's also looking at multiple different relationship dynamics, which I find very interesting. We do get to meet Jason Segel's character's dad at one point, who is so unbelievably funny. Oh my God. And you see why he is kind of the way that he is. And I think that that's like a very important contextual aspect of like why he is kind of like so stifled in his life. But the two of them are really miserable for each other. And like, they're not in a good place. They're not in a good relationship. And it's very clearly because their careers are also not going where they need to be. And they have resentment towards one another. So the movie spends most of the time, you know, us cheering for them to destroy each other. We want to enjoy and revel in them killing each other. And then once they are encroached upon by this trio of criminals and they have to get back together, it does sort of twist your perspective a little bit. And then you're like, okay, maybe I really want them to survive because these people are so much worse. Maybe their relationship will be made stronger by this. Maybe, like, you know, we'll forge them through the fire. And the way that this movie explores is that they completely debase the two of them and they force the other to see their partner in the literal worst possible scenario humanly possible. And sometimes, like, you do kind of have to go through hell and hit that rock bottom to like really see the forest for the trees. And that's what this movie is doing. And I think that this movie also kind of pulls off a magic trick in a lot of ways because it shows situations that can be funny. Like, I guess like spoiler alert, trigger warning, but like there is some sexual violence that doesn't ever actually happen, but is very much teased upon. And In the audience I was in, I was like, this scene is a Rorschach test because some people are like hooting and hollering and laughing and like, haha, prison rape is so funny. And then there are other people that are like, no, this is fucking horrifying. And we become Samara Weaving watching this man that she has married, you know, have this threat thrust upon him. And it's like, no, this is horrifying. And so I was like, wow, this is a fascinating like thing to be exploring right now within the context of this movie, because I do think that that moment is the turning point for them as a couple of like, this just got really, really real because it is a specific type of violence that is so much more violating than even the violence that they were planning on each other. And like, that is the aha moment that they have of like, oh no, I actually don't want you to be like tortured and torn apart. This is, that's actually really bad. I don't want this.
Yeah. And it's so interesting that it's not, the sexual violence is not being threatened against Samara Weaving's character, which is like the thing that you've seen so many times in so many other different movies. And it's like, it becomes a statement about Jason Segel's character and his masculinity and like the lack of the helplessness that he feels and not being able to do anything in that moment. Those roles are reversed in this scenario. And so it's just interesting that that is the choice that was made here. Brad, totally. Brad, what do you think about that part of the movie and kind of like the underlying metaphor that it was, that's kind of like at the beating heart of it?
Yeah, for sure. You know, I think that that's one of the things this movie does really well and why it worked for me is like it's there's a lot more going on here than just beyond the, oh man, this is so funny because like it's like dark and grotesque comedy with like increasingly worse injuries and like the violence getting a laugh. BJ is totally right. Like that's definitely a turning point, and like that is supposed to be a moment where it is scary. And I like that Yorma was able to really dance this delicate line between keeping the movie grounded and making sure that you feel the fear and you feel the concern, and that the violence feels very much real. And it you're with these characters, you're scared for them, you root for them, even after what they've just attempted to put each other through. And I think that being able to keep this movie firmly in reality for the most part, despite some of the heightened comedic sensibilities that it has, is a really good trick for Yorma to pull off.
Nice. Yeah, anything else you guys wanted to say about the movie? I really do want to just kind of open the floor if there were any aspects of it that jumped out at you.
Ooh, for me, like... The music in this movie, I think, is really funny. There's a couple like needle drop moments where they have songs that they've created for the movie that just really elevate the scenes that are happening. And I don't want to give away what they are, but yeah, big, big fan of that.
Yeah, there's that one particular sequence that has three different like club techno songs that Yorm and his brother definitely made for the movie. And I even saw in the credits that they got Samara Weaving and Karen Gillan somehow. I'm not sure how this happened. I didn't get a chance to ask Yorm about it. And Juliette Lewis to do like audio samples in those songs. So like they're featured in those songs that they created. But yeah there's hilarious. There's some really fun twists. You know, and like I said, the moment when Timothy Oliphant, Juliette Lewis, and Keith Jardine come into that scene, like that's just a great drop. Like the line is like, "That's your favorite movie?" Is like, and then all the lead up to that is really good too. And just I like that all the little, you know, clues and stuff that were laid beforehand and how it all comes together. And seeing Jason Segel basically put into like the role that we've seen Samara Weaving do a few times now, of where he's like the one getting more and more increasingly bloody, because Samara Weaving has done this a little bit here and there with Ready or Not and some other movies, and she gets her fair share of wounds and stuff. But seeing Jason Segel just get beat to hell in this movie was a lot of fun. And I always love seeing Jason Segel's like big wild-eyed like expressions when he starts losing his mind. Like that's one of my favorite versions of Jason Segel.
Yeah. What'd you think about the central performances in this, BJ?
Oh, I love them. I mean, Samara Weaving can do no wrong in my eyes. She's never done a bad performance. Even if the movie she's in is not great, she's the best part of it always. Like, I love her so much. But this was a really nice surprise for me from Jason Segel, especially because I am just knee-deep in Shrinking World, so I'm very used to this kind of character out of him. But the thing that I love is that, like, in the Trip, the movie that this is based on, the guy in the Jason Segel role is so hateable, like instantly hateable. You hate this man. But Jason Segel still looks like Jason Segel. He still has those beautiful little doe eyes that made you fall in love with him and Freaks and Geeks, even when he was a shitty boyfriend in that show too. And I think it really plays into the strength of this script, because you immediately root for Samara Weaving because she's Samara Weaving. But then you also want to root for Jason Segel because, oh, just look at him. Is he a man or is he a Muppet? Who knows?
Excellent. All right. Well, Brad, you had a chance to speak with Yorma Taconi about this. Do you want to just jump right into the interview or what?
Yeah, for sure. It was a great talk. I was very happy to complete my Lonely Island trifecta. I'd previously talked to Andy Samberg and Akiva Schaffer a couple times, and so I hadn't talked to Yorma, even though he thought he remembered me for some reason. I'm assuming that's just because I probably look like, you know, most dude film bloggers out there with a beard and glasses. But yeah, this was a really fun conversation, and yeah, it's good stuff.
Okay, here is Brad and Yorma Taconi.
It's so good to talk to you, man. I loved Over Your Dead Body. It's so funny. It's so bloody. It's just a good time.
Dude, thank you. And thank you for that digital shirt that you're wearing.
Yeah. So the funny thing is I actually emailed the podcast to like send it because I wasn't sure when you guys were going to get around to shirts. So I figured I might as well just wear it today.
I love it. By the way, I have designed one or two shirts and they suck. They're terrible.
Amazing. So I want to start off by asking the feature comedies you've directed before, there's a level of absurdity there that didn't require you to have much of a grounded reality, but this movie needs to have its feet mostly planted firmly on the ground in order for you to like feel that authenticity. So like what was the challenging thing about dancing that line between the comedy and then keeping it so that it feels genuine and like you are invested in the story and the characters?
Well, I will put it in the camp of like yes, you're dead right, obviously, like with something like MacGruber, which is like off the rails. But it's funny though, because like as a director, you are still having to protect tone. And like honestly, like when we were doing MacGruber, like when you make it like especially like an SNL comedy, like everyone wants to do jokes. Like costume department wants to do jokes, like the like, you know, even sets and da-da-da. And your job is really like, especially with something like that, you're still building a real world to then have the wrong character in it. Yeah. Right. Like, so even though it's like, you know, it's like, I always compare it to like in Tango and Cash when they like shoot the tanker full of cocaine. Like, we couldn't even do that. You know what I mean? Like, that would be way over the top for like the world of Maguire. So like, so I am used to the idea of, even on a small scale, protecting tone to be able to like, and so like, so, but you know, when talking to Tommy and talking to Guy Donnell, like the producers of this, when I was first talking, like because people only trust what's on your resume of what you can do, like I had to be like, yo, I understand what this is. Like, I love the original, and like, and the violence and the fear and the drama and the danger needing to all be real to be able to even get the humor to work in this was like something I wanted to be like, I get it, guys. I really promise you, I know how to do this sort of thing. And like, and so yeah, I was really wanting to do it for the challenge of doing all of these different tones and things that like I haven't done before. But yeah, like you, it's a huge part of it is protecting that world, grounding it, like, which like the first part of the movie is really grounding you in this relationship that it feels real enough so that you can go on this journey. And just making sure that all that worked, was crucial, obviously.
Yeah. Speaking of that, I like, obviously, you know, in any movie, the characters have to go on an arc and for, in order for the story to be satisfying. And this one has to take Lisa and Dan from like the darkest end of a relationship to the exact opposite spectrum. What was the process like of figuring out how to gradually get there while you're piecing the movie together in order to like give it enough room to breathe and feel like the ending was earned?
I love that part of it. I've been saying that, like obviously I've edited comedy forever. Like, I feel like the action and like, and the, you know, the gore and the violent stuff edits very similar to comedy. Like, you know, it's like the shock of violence is very much like telling a joke sort of thing. But to me, like the really fun part of this one to me is that, like, you know, their relationship does happen over, like, and this is the case in many movies, that it's happening basically over the course of like 5 or 6 scenes that you can kind of plot out like how their relationship is going, the core relationship is going. And like, and to be able to do scenes that were like real acting scenes that you get to like actually leave the camera, not interrupt, like go up to your actors and give smaller directions that can like, you know, you're guiding, but these are incredible actors as well. But I it was really fun for me to be able to like sit in more like actual drama scenes and like have that stuff, not be scared of things that like get dark, get emotional, get like, you know, I loved, for instance, like we really built the schedule to be like that the very last scene that you're left with is the scene in the closet that they have, which is a very emotional scene, which is like a coming back, you know, it's the coming back together of these two people. And like, and having that be our thing that is like, you're all this family, we're in Finland, you're doing this like emotional, like, you know, at the core, it's still a fun, crazy movie sort of thing, but it's at the core, it's the, like the relationship between these two people, and to like end with that and have it be like the, like, and we forgive each other and we're sorry. It's like a really, it was nice. It was really nice. And like, you know, I grew up in theater as well. So in that way, like, I wasn't scared of that. And I love talking to actors about like process and all that sort of stuff. So it was just fun for me to be able to do that, like, you know, totally different shades of certainly what people would expect from me.
Yeah. Touching upon that, I was curious, how did the script change, if you really, you know, much at all, once you came on board? Because it felt like there maybe might have been like some personal touches, especially that conversation in the car, you know, knowing that you and your wonderful wife, Mariel Heller, are both accomplished filmmakers and actors, that some of those conversations felt like they came from like a pretty real place.
I think the parts that like really like the podcast scene is like exactly like that. I put that in. That was exactly our lives. Like my podcast is like World War II stuff. Like I'm like an 80-year-old man. And hers is actually Bitch Sesh, which is like the podcast that she listens to occasionally. But no, I think that like what was cool about it was that like all of us, like they, from producers Nick and Brian to me to like Samara to like to Jason, like, you know, there's things in there that they like in the, for instance, in the dining room scene, like I wanted Jason and Samara to like write their own grievances. That sort of like, you know, so like the both of them have things that they've put in that are like their own things from, you know, like we, it's hard being in a relationship. Like the movie ends with two people floating in a boat together. And that's like kind of the metaphor for any relationship. It's like, are you gonna jump in the water? Or are you gonna do this? But yeah, I think that like that's hopefully that's the stuff that's like really relatable to anybody who's actually like tried to be in a relationship.
Yeah, 100%. So I couldn't help but notice that when Jason Segel is like all banged up, bumps and bruises and whatnot, that he kind of looks a lot more like Connor's disguise and Popstar. Please tell me that came up during production.
Absolutely not. But I will say, Jason Segel's a very, very handsome, very charming man who is good looking. And I still, we have never talked about that scene. And it is unfortunate. And obviously, like, yes, he is fucked up though by the end of the film, and very comically so.
Yeah, absolutely.
And yes, it would only require the same amount of makeup that Andy has on to get him to that state.
I think that you might maybe be the only filmmaker who has two movies now that has the line, "You're a motherfucking titty sucking two ball bitch."
Oh, that's true. Yeah, and by the way, that was Juliet improvising.
Oh wow!
And when she did that, I was like, oh shit, because everybody has their own version of that from like third grade, or I do. But I was very surprised when she said it. I was just like, oh, this is great. Like I didn't realize that. I was like, I thought this was like just a Northern California thing. I don't know. Yeah. I've never, you know, like in normal life as an adult, you don't say that to someone. You know, no, what I mean, like that doesn't come up of something that you say. So yes, I was thrilled. Like when she said it.
Another quick bit that I was curious about is there's a quick shot of a news broadcast talking about Felix the raccoon sitting on the roofs of people's cars. Is that like a carryover of the hot rod bit of the dog walked itself home, ate a pizza, and took a nap?
I would say basically. So that actor is in I don't know if you know the Fatal Farm guys, but Zag and Jeffrey are fucking hilarious. They did all anyway, really, really fun guys. They did lasagna cap. Anyway, so those guys used that actor, his name is Bill Jones, I believe. And he was in a promo that I was like, hey, let these guys do whatever they want for the MacGruber TV series. And they had him as like a current affair type reporter who was interviewing MacGruber in prison and like was doing like a, and he's so funny. And I like immediately called those guys up and was like, we need this reporter. Like he's like, and so I hit Bill up and before production even started, he went over to my friend's house and shot in green screen. And I just wrote up a whole bunch of copy and 100% that I was like, this is my favorite shit to do is make reporters say crazy shit.
Yeah.
And like the other one that was like, was in Hot Rod that got cut out was like a different version of that was and that's why whales are stupid in other news.
Awesome.
Yeah.
One last thing I want to talk about is the ending real quick. You have Kumail Nanjiani popping up in full on shirtless action mode. Did it take any convincing to get him to do that?
No, it didn't. I mean, I hit him up like early days to be like, yo, we need somebody to like really be a awesome reveal in this. And I did want it to be different than the original. The original is slightly, it's a joke that I it's not my joke, but like, but I wanted this to be like a really fun reveal for the audience, and have it be somebody really surprising and like, and fucking Kumail's body is definitely for comedy folks. Surprising.
Yeah.
And he's so kick-ass, and like, and so I just love him as a person. Like, we've been trying to work together for the longest time, so I think so. And so no, it was pretty like easy ask, and then more surprising that he was willing to do it. And then fun fact, it's that the rest of the cast who are in the movie within the movie are like the woman Ina is her name, is like one of the biggest actors in Finland.
Oh wow.
What is his name? I'm blanking on it right now. But like, we have the one of the original bad guys from Andre, like is from the original film, is in it. And then Ilka, is his name Ilka? is in some video game. Like, you would know it. He's this massive character in this huge video game.
Okay.
As well. And they're like some of the biggest actors in Finland. They're awesome. Cool.
Awesome. Well, they gave me the light, Jorm, but it was so good talking to you. Love the movie. And of course, Quaid Army, man.
Right skill.
And then, Brad, you also had a chance to talk to Jason Segel and Samara Weaving.
Yeah, this was also a lot of fun. Although you have the challenge of talking to a very pregnant Samara Weaving. And as you'll hear in the interview, Jason acknowledges that it seemed like Samara was really going through it that day and that the baby might arrive at any moment. So, but we still did our best. And one of my favorite parts of this, too, is at the very end, I took some time to talk to Jason Segel about the Muppets and hopefully, you know, a reunion with them, since Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg have revived the Muppet Show, and hopefully that will continue to have momentum and the show will come back in a big way. And just seeing him light up talking about the Muppets, like, you can tell that, like, it's just one of his most favorite things that he's ever done.
Awesome. All right. Well, here is Brad, Jason Segel, and Samara Weaving. Just a quick heads up. Some of the audio here is a little wonky, but there's really nothing we could do about it. This is just the file that we have to work with. So apologies there, but here is Brad's conversation.
Hello, guys. It's great to talk to you over your dead body. It's hilarious and bloody and wonderful and great, and you are both phenomenal in it.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
So to begin with, Samara, obviously you're quite experienced when it comes to being chased and getting bloody. Jason, I think this is probably the most gory and beat up that you've gotten in a movie. Totally. So, Samara, do you ever get used to getting covered in fake blood and prosthetic wounds? And Jason, how was the experience for you doing it in this movie?
Yeah, do you know what? I did a film that is coming out later this year called Caroline to Caroline, and I didn't have one drop of blood on me.
Wow.
The whole thing felt a bit weird.
Yeah.
But
I can't wait
great.
To see it.
Oh, it's good.
Yeah.
You're going to love it.
I can't wait.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah, most of the time I am a little bit covered in goo and guts.
Yeah. It was really fun for me to do something like totally off my normal beaten path, and I didn't know how to do some of it, and Sam was a great teammate in that, and I had a blast. I actually miss Finland.
Let's go back. I want to go summertime.
Yeah. If there's a sequel.
Let's go in the summer.
Summertime.
That'll be non-negotiable.
Okay.
Samara, on a related note, you get to bite an ear off in this movie. Yeah. When you do that, does the special effects team try and make it so it doesn't taste bad, or do you just have to deal with it?
Yeah, no, fake blood is quite tasty. It's kind of tastes like caramel sauce.
Oh,
like,
okay.
You could put it on an ice cream.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Big time.
Big time.
Now, on a more serious note, aside from the obvious conflict between Lisa and Dan in this movie when they're fighting literally and figuratively, both of you do a really good job of expressing the quiet disdain that your characters have for each other when they're not looking. Is that something that you two worked on together in order to enhance the dynamic between Lisa and Dan?
I don't think we did. We just started when we were doing line reads, when we were doing read-throughs on Zoom. We kind of fell into this funny.
We did. That's right.
And I remember going, oh, yeah, this is going to be fun.
I think even when you're in the best relationship, you've gone through these periods where you're like in a private war. You know what I mean? Like, even if it's about something dumb, you know what I mean? Like a kitchen remodel, like, you know.
How much is it?
Yeah. And so I think it's I think what's cool about the movie is it's obviously very broad and it strokes about this stuff, but like, I think everybody's had these feelings before.
Yeah. I talked to Jorma about the movie a little bit earlier, and he mentioned that he had you guys write your own grievances for each other. Can you talk about the process of figuring that out?
Oh yeah, Jason's was so funny about my accent. I loved that. Yeah, that was just like a cool experiment. I hadn't really done that before. I can't remember what I wrote initially.
Mine was mainly about the accent.
Yeah.
In my younger days, I had dated an Australian woman. And I just remember always feeling like she was making fun of me. Even if she was being nice or saying something loving, I'm like,
it is a sarcastic accent. Yeah. There's something so dry about it where you're like, yeah, no, good for you. And you're going,
yeah.
No, I loved it.
Oh.
No, it's really good.
Oh, God.
I'm serious.
Yeah. See?
Now, Samara, did you find that, did you have to lay on your accent any thicker as Lisa to, like, emphasize that? Or was there ever a time where you had to, like, tone it down because Americans are generally bad at understanding accents?
Both. I made her much more ocker than I am. And, yes, there's outtakes of Yorma going, can you please enunciate? We don't know what you're saying.
Yeah.
Which, yeah. I don't know. Americans either.
Now, with so much blood and gore and dismemberment and all these things, what was one of the hardest days that you guys had shooting?
I think there was the days on the boat. There was no bathroom.
That's right. There were some days on the boat that were hard. And then there was a couple days where I spent 2 days. You were standing. You were standing, but I was crawling through mud. In the outside scene when the car arrives and we've fallen through the window,
yeah.
I was just on the ground crawling through mud for most of those 2 days. And it was winter in Finland. Everything was freezing. The ground was freezing. I was wet and covered in mud. But we were just saying, like, those are the things that you look back on and think, how cool was that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The misery of it drops away pretty quickly after, you know?
Yeah, like childbirth, you forget.
Right.
Don't you?
Oh, gosh. I don't know if you can see, but she is like, it's happening now. She's full on.
I'm in labor, technically.
We're going for it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's going to be the first interview with a live birth happening.
Yeah.
No, really.
I wanted to talk to you about working with Timothy Oliphant, too, because he's somehow both effortlessly cool and also incredibly intimidating. Like, what was that like in, like, feeling that intensity from him as a villain in this movie?
I was so intimidated. I've been such a fan. I watched Deadwood growing up. He was my favorite. And then meeting him, and he's so lovely and, like, sweet and has sort of manic energy to him that's really fun.
That's right.
And really gets, like, morale up. It's good to have on set because, you know, you can be tired, but not with Tim.
It's really true.
You know,
do you remember he would tell stories? He would be telling stories from, like, other jobs right up to action, and you're like, is he going to stop this story? And then they would yell action, and then he would do something terrifying and menacing, and then you all cut, and then he would, like, pick right back up, and he would go right back with the story.
He doesn't need a minute to, like, get into it. I would remember going, is he going to, he's gonna do it. It was wild. It was amazing.
It was amazing.
Speaking of which, Jason, when you get, like, wild-eyed and, like, yelling and crazy, like, it's, like, hilarious, but also a little bit terrifying.
Oh, good. I'm glad. I'm a big dude, you know? It's like, I play, you know, often, like, America's boyfriend kind of guy. But I'm a big guy, and so it was really fun to, like, very rarely has my body of work called me to, like, flex any masculinity. So it was it was really fun.
That's awesome. So for both of you, how are you killing somebody if you're pushed to the brink like your characters are in this movie?
Oh, well. What do we get? you know, let's see. Maybe you, like, don't mount something really heavy in the house and then plan an earthquake and happen to be having a conversation near the heavy thing. Faultless.
She's the master of this. She's been coming up with creative ways to murder somebody all day long.
Maybe there's a slippery banana, but it's really slippery. A little too slippery.
I think I'd be curious to see how you plan an earthquake, because that might be the most lucrative idea.
Have you seen Ocean's movie when Brad Pitt
Oh
lands?
My God, that's
oh,
right.
Yeah. Good point, yeah.
Call up that guy.
You do not mess around.
Maybe he looks like Brad
Cheadle.
Pitt.
Yeah, no, it was Don Cheadle who set off the earthquake.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Piece of cake.
Yeah.
As I wrap up here, Jason, I have to ask, you've worked with Seth Rogen several times before, and he's just come off doing The Muppet Show at Disney+. what are the odds, if any, that if there's a series revival that happens after that, you might be able to return to the Muppets universe? And because I don't want to leave Samara out of the fun with the Muppets, who's the Muppet that you'd want to work with the most?
Boy.
Listen, my goal is that the Muppets thrive forever in any capacity I can help with that has been my goal. I mean, I making that Muppet movie was the highlight of my career, especially at the time. It was just like they've been posters on my walls and figurines on my shelves and movies I watched for inspiration since I was, you know, just a little kid. My mom taped every episode of The Muppet Show for me because I was a little too young to watch them and then showed them to me on VHS when I got older. So I have real, really fond memories of The Muppets. Yeah.
I don't know. Wait, but I get confused. Is Oscar the Grouch?
Well, he's Sesame Street, but they cross over. They're all Jim Henson, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I really like Oscar the Grouch. Yeah. He speaks to me.
He pops up every once in a while. There's a great Sesame Street movie called Follow That Bird.
Yeah, great movie.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, okay. So good.
Yeah, I want to hang out with Oscar.
Cool. Right on. Jason, are there any Muppets that you didn't get to hang out with that you'd still love to?
I got to hang out with most of them, and I'm like, yeah. I don't know what I'm allowed to say, but I got to puppeteer Animal.
Oh, man.
And I got to puppeteer Dr. Teeth.
That's amazing.
And I had Kermit on my arm for a minute. I didn't get to puppeteer him, but they let me wear him for a minute. But yeah, in some of those scenes where we're in the car picking up the other Muppets, the car was too tight to fit puppeteers. So I'm sitting there with fake arms, like human arms, and my real arms are operating the puppets next to me.
That's so cool.
Yeah, pretty cool.
I love that. Awesome. Well, thanks so much, guys. I love the movie. Congratulations. And yeah, take care.
Thanks, man.
Okay, that'll do it for this episode of the show. You can find more about some of the stories we mentioned on today's show at slashfilm.com. I will link to a bunch of stuff in the show notes, as usual. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Check out patreon.com/popculture to hear more from many of the folks that you heard on this episode. Actually, everybody on this episode has appeared on a pop cultured or pop cultured adjacent podcast on that site at some point or another. Chris is the only one who's not been on like the main feed episodes for us, but he and Brad Oman and I do a Simpsons rewatch podcast that's been really fun over there. So you can subscribe to that at patreon.com/popcultured. You can send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really does help us out a lot. If you could take a second and just leave us a star rating and write a sentence or two about what you think about the show, that would be a huge help. Also, another huge help, tell your friends about the show. If you have people in your life who love movies and TV shows and would appreciate some insight that we might provide here, whether it's in the form of the commentary or the interviews or anything like that, it would mean a great deal to me if you could send an episode of this show to a friend and say, hey, check this out. If you like this stuff, I think you'll get something out of it. So that is my request to you. And that's going to do it for the episode. Thank you so much for listening, everyone. And we'll talk to you next time.